gold, the Bitcoin hold.com. The Bitcoin self-custody is the whole. Find the strength inside your soul. Your soul. Oh, the Bitcoin hold.com.
You know, if you're building a house, right, and you need to cut a piece of wood, you obviously trust your tape measure. You line it up, you make your mark at, say, exactly 2 inches, and you make the cut. But what if your tape measure got warped in the sun?
Yeah, you've got a huge problem then.
Right. You have the exact number you were looking for in the tool, but the physical reality doesn't match the math. You just have, you know, the illusion of precision.
And honestly, false confidence is it's infinitely more dangerous than knowing your tools are weak. Because when you know a system is fragile, you act defensively, you double check things.
Exactly.
But when a system lies to you about how secure it is, you just completely leave your guard down.
Welcome to this week's deep dive. We mention this concept a lot, but Bitcoin self-custody, it's not a set it and forget it feature. It is a serious craft.
It really is.
It requires continuous learning, and this week's report is entirely focused on that exact theme. We're looking at precision and mathematical guarantees.
We have a pretty deep stack of developments to get through today. We're looking at major hardware updates that protect against the exact false security we just mentioned. Plus, we're tracking a massive shift toward true software privacy.
And some post-quantum stuff, right?
Yeah, post-quantum cryptography developments from Blockstream. And later on, we are going to unpack the bit-by-bit mechanics of programming time itself into your Bitcoin.
So by the end of this deep dive, you won't just know what changed in the Bitcoin ecosystem this week. You are going to understand the deep technical reasons why these changes actually protect your wealth.
That's the goal.
So let's start with the physical foundation of self-custody, which is hardware signing devices and seed generation. Because if your physical randomness, like your entropy, is weak, your entire security stack is just built on sand.
That is the foundation of everything, which is exactly what makes the new 2.5.0 firmware update for the Keystone 3 so critical. They just released a patch for their dice roll entropy validation.
Okay, let me stop you there, because I think the concept of entropy confuses a lot of people.
Oh, definitely.
If I take a handful of dice, right, and I roll them on my table, and then I use a device to convert those rolls into 24 words, isn't that inherently 256-bit security? Like, why does the exact number of physical dice rolls actually matter if I end up with a 24-word phrase anyway?
Well, that is the trap of the stretch tape measure we were just talking about.
Yeah.
The number of words does not magically create randomness. The math behind this is it's completely stubborn.
Okay, break that down for me.
So a standard six-sided die provides about 2.58 bits of entropy per roll. So if you roll the die 50 times, you are generating roughly 129 bits of physical randomness.
Right, which is enough for a 12-word seed phrase. Because 12 words require 128 bits of security.
Correct. But to get true 256-bit security, which is what a 24-word phrase actually represents, you must roll that die at least 100 times.
Oh, okay.
What Keystone found was that users were, you know, rolling the dice 50 times, getting tired or bored, and the device was allowing them to force a 24-word phrase out of that limited randomness.
Oh, wow. So you are walking around thinking you have this mathematically impenetrable 24-word vault, but you're actually carrying 12-word entropy that's just stretched out and disguised in 24-word packaging.
Precisely. You think you have 256-bit security, but you actually have half of that. So the new Keystone update refuses to let your phrase lie to you. It simply hides the 24-word option entirely until you have physically logged 100 valid rolls.
It forces you to respect the math. I absolutely love that. Because humans are lazy. You know?
We really are. We want the shortcut.
Right. And while we're talking about rigorous hardware updates, CoinKai just dropped the 5.5.1 update for the cold card MK4 and MK5, as well as the 1.4.1Q update for the new cold card Q.
Yeah, the cold card Q updates are heavily focused on power users. They've introduced grouping for secure notes and passwords and standalone encrypted 7Z backups, which is great.
Yeah, that's huge.
But the feature that really changes the game for legacy users is the new WI store feature.
I saw that in the changelog, and I have to admit, I've been around Bitcoin for a long time, but I'm not entirely sure what WIF actually stands for in this specific context.
Yeah, WIF stands for Wallet Import Format. If you ever created a paper wallet back in, say, 2013 or 2014, OAuthUIF is basically your raw private key converted into a string of text that is easy to print out or write down.
Okay, so it's literally the raw key itself. But historically, if you found an old paper wallet with funds on it, the recovery process was just an absolute security nightmare.
Oh, it was terrifying. You usually had to take that printed wife key and physically type it into a hot desktop wallet connected to the internet just to sweep the funds.
Right, which completely defeats the entire purpose of cold storage. You're taking a key that has never touched the internet and typing it directly into a highly vulnerable environment.
And that's exactly what the WIF store feature solves. Now you scan the QR code of the paper wallet, or you type the WIF key directly into the offline cold card queue. The cold card stores it safely offline and then exports a watch-only descriptor. You take that public descriptor, put it into Electrum or Sparrow on your desktop, build your transaction, and pass it back to the cold card via an SD card to sign it.
So the private key never leaves the physical piece of paper and the offline hardware device. It completely air gaps the legacy recovery process.
It completely insulates it. I mean, between this cold card update, Keystone tightening up their dice math, the new Bitbox Zodu Nova launching with native iPhone support, and Foundation dropping their limited passport Prime America 250 edition, there is a massive amount of hardware innovation happening right now.
It's honestly a lot to keep track of. So if you are currently evaluating your own signing setup or looking to upgrade to something more robust, you should really check out the hardware wallets comparison feature on thebitcoinhole.com. It's a great tool because it lets you filter by these exact security models, like air gapping, dice rolls, secure elements, to find the device that fits your specific needs.
Yeah, it's a great resource, and understanding those specific hardware details is crucial because we just got a really stark reminder that hardware is never magically bulletproof.
Right, Tropic Square.
Exactly. Tropic Square just released a transparent security audit for their TruEuropa 01 secure element. They hired independent researchers at KU Leuven to attack the chip, and they used something called laser fault injection.
Laser fault injection. But that sounds like a weapon from a sci-fi movie. How do you attack a hardware wallet with a laser?
I know, it sounds super exotic, but it's a very real physical attack vector. Yeah. So a silicon chip is essentially a microscopic city of wires and switches. When the chip is processing something critical, like, say, verifying your PIN, it executes instructions step by step.
Okay, I'm with you.
If an attacker decapsulates the chip, meaning they physically open it up, and they fire a highly precise laser at a specific transistor at the exact microsecond a security check is happening, the photon energy can actually induce a tiny voltage spike.
And what does that spike actually do?
It flips a bit. It can literally cause the processor to skip the instruction that says, is this PIN correct? And just jump straight to PIN verified, unlock the device.
That is absolutely wild. They're using the laws of physics to bypass the software logic.
Yes. The researchers actually found vulnerabilities using this exact method. Tropic Square patched them via firmware for the current silicon by adding redundant checks, and they are heavily hardening the ROM bootloader for the next physical revision.
Wow.
It proves that while secure element is vital, defense in depth is mandatory. You just have to assume that if an attacker has physical access to your device for a long enough time, the fortress walls will eventually be tested.
That brings up a really fascinating dynamic. You can build the most impenetrable physical fortress in the world, complete with verified dice rolls and laser-resistant silicon. But the moment you want to broadcast a transaction or check your balance, your fortress has to send a messenger out into the public Bitcoin network.
Right.
And how you send that messenger determines whether your privacy actually survives.
Which brings us to the major software release this week, which is Bitcoin Safe 2.0. And the headline feature here is that compact block filters are now the default network syncing option.
I want to make sure everyone understands why this is such a massive leap forward. Because the old way of syncing your wallet using public Electrum servers is essentially like walking into a massive public library and asking the librarian, excuse me, do you have any books checked out under my specific name and home address?
That's a great analogy, the librarian tells you, but now the librarian and anyone standing nearby knows exactly who you are, what books you're reading, and where you live. In Bitcoin terms, you are just handing your entire financial footprint and your IP address over to a third-party server operator.
It's a massive privacy leak. So how do compact block filters fix this?
Well, compact block filters flip the architecture upside down. Instead of asking the librarian about your specific identity, you download a highly compressed, tiny index of the entire library.
The filter itself.
Exactly. You download this tiny mathematical filter locally to your own device. You check your addresses against the filter privately. If the filter says, hey, there might be a transaction for you in block 800,000, you then just ask the network to give you the entirety of block 800,000.
So the network just sees you asking for a generic block, not a specific address.
Right. You figure out what you actually need privately behind closed doors. By making this the default, BitcoinSafe 2.0 removes the user's dependency on those external Electrum servers.
That is a massive sovereignty upgrade.
It really is. And they paired this privacy upgrade with a completely rebuilt device-focused signing flow that handles QR codes, USB, Bluetooth, and SD connections natively across major hardware devices.
Well, speaking of Electrum, they also had a major release this week with version 4.8.0. I was reading through the changelog, and a couple of things really stood out. First, they patched CDE 2012-2459, which they described as an SPV verification bug related to rejecting left sibling duplicates in Merkle trees.
Yeah, that's a mouthful.
I feel like I need a computer science degree just to read that sentence. What does that actually mean for the average user?
It is dense, but the concept is actually pretty elegant once you break it down. SPV stands for Simplified Payment Verification. It's how light wallets operate without having to download the entire 500 gigabyte blockchain. They rely on something called a Merkle tree.
Right.
Which is basically a way of hashing transactions in pairs over and over, building a pyramid until you get a single hash at the very top.
So if I want to prove a specific transaction is in a block, I don't need the whole block. I just need the specific branches of that pyramid that lead from my transaction up to the top.
Exactly. But the bug they patched was kind of a historical quirk. Under certain conditions, an attacker could artificially duplicate a transaction on the left side of a branch to trick the SPV client into accepting a fake proof. Electrum updated their logic to strictly reject those left sibling duplicates, closing the vulnerability.
Okay, that makes total sense. They also made some major improvements to the Lightning Network side of the wallet, specifically adding something called lazy trampoline routing.
Yes.
We know standard onion routing on Lightning is sort of like passing a locked box through multiple middlemen, where each middleman only has the key to peel off one layer of encryption to see who to hand it to next. But what makes trampoline routing different?
Well, the challenge with standard routing is that your mobile phone has to know the map of the entire Lightning Network to plot the path in the first place. That map requires a lot of memory and bandwidth.
Right, which isn't great for a mobile device.
Exactly. So trampoline routing allows your phone to say, look, I don't know the full path to the destination, but I know a massive, well-connected node trampoline. I'm going to wrap my payment in encryption, toss it to the trampoline node, and just let them figure out the rest of the path.
And because of the encryption, that trampoline node doesn't know who originally sent the payment or who the ultimate receiver is.
Right. It delegates the heavy lifting of pathfinding without sacrificing the privacy of the onion routing.
That's super clever.
But honestly, the best part of the Electrum 4.8.0 release wasn't even the cryptography. It was a tiny update to their crash reporter.
Yes, I saw that. They explicitly improved the crash reporter to better detect altcoin forks, just so the software can efficiently ignore them.
Yeah, they just drop them.
It's a perfect reminder of our ethos here. We do not care about the broader crypto market. We don't care about the noise, the tokens, or whatever the next big fad is. We just want our tools to aggressively reject that static and stay laser focused on Bitcoin.
It reflects a very specific philosophy of engineering. You optimize for the signal, not the noise. And that philosophy leads us directly into how infrastructure builders are fortifying the network against tomorrow's threats.
Yeah, let's zoom out to the future.
Yeah.
Because I constantly see headlines about quantum computing. And honestly, it often feels like a buzzword designed to sell consulting fees to corporations.
Oh, it definitely is used that way.
Blockstream just released their Q2 2026 update, and a massive chunk of it is dedicated to a post-quantum proposal called OP Check Schreins. Is quantum computing an actual threat to Bitcoin, or is this just theoretical fear-mongering?
So it is not a threat today, but it is a mathematically inevitable threat in the future. The specific vulnerability lies with exposed public keys.
By exposed, you mean addresses where someone has reused them, or maybe the very early pay to public key outputs from the early days of Bitcoin.
Exactly. In modern Bitcoin, your public key is hashed. It's hidden behind an extra layer of math until the exact moment you spend from it. But if the public key is already sitting exposed on the blockchain, a sufficiently powerful future quantum computer could run an algorithm, specifically Shor's algorithm, to derive the private key directly from the public key and steal the funds.
That's terrifying. So the industry definitely needs a migration path. How does OPCHECK Shrein solve this?
What's fascinating is the approach Blockstream Research took, because much of the tech world is kind of panicking and rushing toward experimental lattice-based cryptography to fight quantum computers.
But lattice math is relatively new, right? It's unproven over long time horizons.
Highly unproven. Blockstream's proposal rejects that completely. OPCHECK Shrein's is a hash-based signature scheme. It doesn't rely on new experimental math at all. It relies purely on SHA-256.
Which is the exact same hash function Bitcoin has relied on flawlessly since day one for proof of work.
Exactly. It adds zero new cryptographic assumptions to Bitcoin. It is a highly conservative opt-in migration path. It can process up to 3 transactions per second with 580 byte signatures. It is just the steady, rigorous Bitcoin way of solving a massive future problem.
Not flashy, just mathematically undeniable. And Blockstream applied that exact same rigorous philosophy to their newly redesigned Simplicity Smart Contracting Language, which is currently deployed on the Liquid mainnet.
Yeah, Simplicity is a massive departure from how the rest of the industry views smart contracts. If you look at general smart contracts on other chains, they are plagued by unpredictability. They fail mid-execution because they run out of gas, or they get drained because of reentrancy bugs. They are fundamentally chaotic.
So how does Simplicity fix the chaos? I read that it is formally verifiable, but how is that actually different from just testing your code really, really thoroughly?
Okay, think of standard software testing, like test driving a car on an obstacle course.
Yeah.
You drive it through mud, you drive it over speed bumps, you crash it into a wall. If it survives, you declare it safe.
Right.
But you didn't test it in a tornado or underwater or at zero gravity. You are bound by the scenarios you can physically imagine.
Right. You can only patch the bugs you stumble across.
Exactly. Formal verification is completely different. It's not a test drive. It is taking the architectural blueprint of the car, applying the laws of physics, and writing a mathematical proof that the chassis cannot break under any physical condition in the universe.
Wow.
With Simplicity, an institution can mathematically prove exactly how a contract will behave and exactly what it will cost before it ever goes live.
So the security isn't bolted on as an afterthought. It is built into the language itself,
mm-hmm.
which is mandatory if you are moving billions of dollars of institutional capital.
Absolutely.
Okay. We've talked about programming mathematical conditions into contracts. Let's explore the ultimate condition you can program into Bitcoin, which is time.
This is one of the most vital areas of Bitcoin script for self-custody, specifically for inheritance and recovery planning.
The team over at the Anna Wallet recently published a fantastic technical breakdown of time locks. And to make this easy to visualize, I want you to think of two tools for measuring time: the calendar and the hourglass.
It's the perfect analogy. Let's start with the calendar, which represents absolute time locks.
So this is setting an exact, unmoving appointment, like January 1st, 2032.
Correct. At the transaction level, this uses a field called nlock time. At the script level, meaning the rules baked into the actual coin itself, it uses the opcode OPCHECKLockTimeVerify, or CLTV for short.
Okay.
It points to a fixed date or a fixed block height in the future. When someone tries to spend the coin, the network looks at the current block height and says, "Has this moment arrived yet?" No. Then the transaction is invalid.
It's set in stone. Very straightforward. Mm-hmm. So how does the hourglass work?
The hourglass represents relative time locks. Instead of a fixed date on a calendar, it measures a duration of time elapsed since a specific event.
Like flipping an hourglass the exact moment a coin lands in your wallet.
Exactly. At the transaction level, this uses the end sequence field. At the script level, it uses OPCHECK Sequence Verify, or CSV. The timer does not care what year it is. The timer starts the exact moment the UTXO is confirmed on the blockchain. If the script says wait 1 year, the network forces you to wait 1 year from the moment you receive that specific coin.
There is a really fascinating piece of Bitcoin archaeology here. Because didn't Satoshi originally design that end sequence field for something completely different? It wasn't meant for time delays initially, right?
You're absolutely right. Originally, Satoshi designed end sequence for transaction replacement. The vision was that two people could hold an unconfirmed transaction in the mempool and continuously update it with newer versions by increasing the sequence number right up until a final deadline.
So sort of a way to keep a tab open without publishing every single micro update to the blockchain.
Right. But the early developers quickly realized that holding unconfirmed transactions open indefinitely was a massive denial of service vector for node operators. It basically allowed infinite spam.
Ah, of course.
So that original mempool replacement logic was disabled very early on,
leaving this orphaned end sequence field just sitting in every single Bitcoin transaction, doing absolutely nothing for years.
Until years later, when the network repurposed it through soft forks, specifically BIP68 and BIP112, to serve as the foundation for these relative time locks, it's a beautiful example of Bitcoin evolving without breaking its foundational structure.
Bringing this back to practical application, though, why does a wallet like Liana exclusively use the Hourglass, the relative time lock, for their self-custody recovery setups?
Because of the realities of human behavior. If you use a calendar and absolute time lock for your inheritance plan, the deadline is constantly approaching. If you set it for 5 years and 4 years pass, you have to completely rebuild your wallet, sweep your UTXOs, and pay on-chain fees just to push the deadline back.
Which introduces more chances to make a mistake, lose a backup, or expose your privacy.
Exactly. But with a relative time lock, the Hourglass, the timer is tied to the coin itself. If you want to reset the clock, you don't need a new script. You just send the coins back to yourself.
You literally just flip the hourglass over.
You flip the hourglass over. The script stays exactly the same. The backup descriptor you gave to your heirs never changes. It is vastly superior for long-term inheritance planning because it requires minimal maintenance while still guaranteeing that if you lose your keys, your family will have access after the predefined inactivity period.
That is brilliant architecture, and I think it perfectly encapsulates what we've been talking about today. Bitcoin self-custody is a living, breathing ecosystem of precision engineering.
It really is. If we summarize the themes we've covered today, we saw that true physical entropy requires mathematically verified dice rolls, not just a word count. We saw that private network syncing via compact block filters is stepping up as the new default standard.
Which is huge.
Definitely. We explored how the core developer ecosystem is proactively building quantum defenses using proven hash-based cryptography. And we unpacked why understanding the script-level mechanics of relative time locks is absolutely essential for passing your wealth to the next generation.
It is a profound responsibility. And if this deep dive helps you keep your own self-custody skills sharp, we do have a small favor to ask. Please take 3 seconds to rate the podcast and leave a comment on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It genuinely helps us continue to bring you this level of technical depth every single week.
And before we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. We talked about Blockstream's post-quantum OP Chick Schreins S proposal. It uses highly secure, proven SHA-256 math, but hash-based signatures are significantly larger in data size than our current signatures.
Right. You mentioned 580 bytes per signature, which is quite a bit heavier than what we use today.
It is. So the question becomes, if quantum computers eventually force the Bitcoin base layer to migrate entirely to these much larger hash-based signatures, how will that increased data load impact the physical storage and bandwidth costs of running a home node?
Will the extra weight push casual node operators off the network? Will it test our ultimate commitment to decentralization?
It's a heavy question, and it reminds us that in Bitcoin, every single solution introduces a new trade-off. We have to make sure our tape measure isn't warped, that our assumptions about the future hold up to the physical and mathematical realities of running the network.
Keep verifying, keep learning, and we'll see you next time.
Hold your own keys. Stay sovereign. The Bitcoin Hold. The Bitcoin Hold.com.